Yeah, good afternoon, and also thanks a lot to the organizers for bringing me to this very nice place here and also letting me talk. They might regret that after the talk. It's a little bit crazy title, and I really took this seriously, what we heard this morning, that one should talk about ideas and maybe basically things one would like to discuss and think about in the next few weeks. I'm lucky enough that I can stay for the next few weeks here. And so I don't have basically answers, I just have ideas here. And the first is time from space, and I couldn't resist to do that, to basically try to tell you that time is an illusion anyway, so why would you like go to basically very short times? But this has a more serious background, and of course we haven't been really able to prove that time is an illusion, but maybe with going to very, very short basically time intervals, we can show that a little bit more. So what I will tell you is that time can be thought of emerging from separation of objects in space. And this implies that time is not absolute, but depends on the kind of separation of these objects. And the problem is that whenever you measure something, basically one object is so big, so incredibly big, this is our measuring apparatus, that all the differences in time go away. And that means time appears to be absolute. And maybe if we can come to smaller and smaller time measurements, we might be able to detect some differences in contrasting several objects. You will see that later on. If you think it's totally crazy, okay, here's something which is a bit more realistic, what you probably expected me to talk about. I will just mention that towards the end. That's attosecond probing of extended systems. That's our idea. An example of taking the charging of clusters, that basically, although the dynamics in these extended systems is generally slow, the critical processes happen actually very fast, on the order of a femtosecond, a bit more. And also, this is what I would like to put forward, that monitoring of incoherent processes can really offer new insight. Insight we haven't been able to get by any other method so far. So you can basically look into something like the evolution of cluster dynamics very early on, while now we can only measure final products by whatever method we could think of. And this would give you some qualitatively new insight. So let's come to the first part. Why would we think about something crazy as basically the creation of time or the origin of time? What really drove us to that is the observation that we have, of course, a beautiful uncertainty relation in quantum mechanics, which is a true operator-based relation as long as you have operators. But just the energy-time uncertainty, as you probably know, is not like that, since time is not an operator. Time is just a parameter, actually a classical parameter. And this is, of course, very strange, and many famous people have thought about this before. And there are essentially two classes of way out. One is try to construct a time operator. This, as far as I can see, has failed so far. I will give you just two examples a little bit later. And the other way, of course, is a bit softer, if you wish, argue and find a way why time is derived. And it's not on the same level, basically, as space and momentum, if you wish, or position and momentum. So let's have a look on the construction of time operators, just to give you a flavor. That's only a few. There are many more around in literature. And basically, people have tried to construct, of course, an operator T for basically this commuter relation, an analogy to the one we know very well. Goes back to Aronoff and Bohm. They basically were inspired by the classical relation that time is basically mass times position over momentum for a particle, free particle of mass m, and gave this operator, and in a bit different way, but along the same spirit, that's not so long ago, only 10 years ago, Gröbedal came up with this one. And you see, both of these operators have the problem that they're singular in p-space, so they're not universally applicable, and this would be a very strange thing for our feeling of time, that depending on the system, time all of a sudden is singular. How much can we say about attempts to justify energy-time uncertainty? There's many, many really proposals, again, in the literature. The one I like best is the one given by Wigner, which I think is fairly elegant. He proposed basically to define moments in time, and as far as I can see, there's nothing against that. At least formally, it will work. And to construct from these moments in time the time uncertainty like this. You could say, okay, this is position dependent, which is not so nice, but you can of course average anyways over your wave function, then it's fine. Another one much earlier by Mandelstam and Tam basically uses the uncertainty relation and basically the algebra we know from generating time-dependent dynamics with the commutator, with the Hamiltonian, also like in classical mechanics with the Poisson bracket, to use then this equation, the time derivative of some observable is given as the expectation value of the commutator, and then we can of course define a time interval just like this. And again, there's here not too much to say against that, apart from the fact, of course, they're using already the time-dependent Schrödinger equation to derive that. And we will be essentially, in the end, we will see that we're using something very similar, but we will give basically this operator a meaning. We will say where it comes from by separating objects in space. Now, this is, towards the wine and cheese party, just a few thoughts how one could think about the separation. I mean, if you really think how we basically conceive time, it's more or less by day and night. I mean, this is really our physiological conception of time, and this is because planets, as we know, are circling, and you have something which remains the same. This is yourself, and you can judge it's day and night, and things are changing, but they're changing actually in space, more or less circling around. So separating objects in space more or less creates time. And yes, you can see if you know your system is conservative, energy conserving, you don't need time at all. So in other words, if Poincaré had lived before Newton, we might think very differently about time. Because if you just have phase space, you can use in a conservative system any variable of the system to basically describe the path in phase space. And then you describe this variable in the end by energy conservation. And time is just a very convenient way to basically avoid singularities in your description, which occur whenever in a phase space point is revisited by your basically path in phase space of your system. Yeah? Then time disentangles that because you can distinguish in time, time point one, time point two, the two basically points where you visit the same part of phase space. And another note, you might know that if you have children of your own, or maybe you remember yourself, a child learns the concept of time about when he or she can say I. In the beginning, they only say their names, and during that time, they're not really certain of themselves, kids, yeah? And they're not able to distinguish time intervals. Tomorrow, today, not even times. So whenever you have separated yourself from your environment, and an indication for that is that you can say I, as opposed to whatever I'm doing, then you also get an idea of time. Finally, to make it even more crazy, in dreams, time is not reliable. And of course, you can interpret that yourself. Separation of self and the world is lost in dreams. You can travel whatever you want. So this is just to motivate for you a little bit that time is connected with the existence of separation. Separation in space. And the question is, how can we translate that into a mathematical description of physical systems? So let's attempt that. We start, and this is a bit the problem of the chicken and the egg, we start with a closed quantum system in an eigenstate, which is everything formally. If it's not everything, it's not closed, and we just basically include anything until it's everything. Yeah? So therefore we start with everything. Now everything doesn't change, that's very boring, that's not what we are used to describe in physics. So therefore we have to do more about it. But the fundamental equation for everything in an eigenstate, you would probably agree with me, is at least non-relativistically the normal Schrödinger equation, the time-independent Schrödinger equation. That's actually the one Schrödinger came up first with. Although he derived the time-dependent one within half a year later, I think, something like that. Okay, so make it more interesting, what we really need is we want to separate a small test system. That's what we want to learn about. So we split our Hamiltonian now into that of the system, into that what's left over, that's the environment, and of course into some coupling between the environment and our small test system. And now we can really say and try to construct, very much in the sense of basically the sun and the planet and so on moving, that time for the small test system S is provided by what's left of everything, the environment. Yeah. So the environment basically defines time for the system. How can we achieve that? Well, we write our wave function, and this might look familiar to people who do a lot of molecular physics, as basically product of an environmental wave function and the system wave function. And you see the system wave function still depends on coordinates of the environment. And moreover, we say, and this is the asymmetry condition, I come to that, our environment is so big that we can solve it semi-classically, basically, here, the environmental wave function. And that gives, of course, the vibrational wave function as for molecules, and that's nothing else but basically applying a Born-Oppenheimer approximation, where we say our small system corresponds to the electrons, and the environment is basically the nuclei. And what is very important, of course, also for the semi-classical treatment here, is that we have this asymmetry condition in terms of energy, that is, the energy of the environment is much, much larger than the energy of the system. U sub S is just basically the expectation value of the system energy. Now, and this is the only basically transparency with a few equations, we can really construct from the time-independent Schrödinger equation of the separated basically objects, system environment, a time-dependent Schrödinger equation for the system itself. How does this work? We simply put in our total time-independent Schrödinger equation, our product wave function, and now we solve it the other way around. We assume we know already, of course, what the environment does. It's a WKB wave function, yeah? And we are interested in the electronic, quote-unquote, wave function. That's the system wave function. Therefore, this looks a bit unusual. Technically, it's the same as the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. So here are all the diagonal parts. Here's the coupling part. That's, of course, the interesting one, which gives us, in the coupling of system and environment, the time dependence in the end. And you see that here, what this looks like. This has several terms, and of course, since we want to be consistent, we are on the semi-classical limit, we only keep the term of lowest order in h-bar, and that's this one. And the action differentiated with respect to position is just momentum, and therefore you end up basically with this coefficients here, and then you can put this together, and it's just the units are correct, and you see this gives you a directional derivative. It's a scalar in the end, and it's just d by dt. And that's the coupling between the electronic, if you wish, that's the system, and the nuclear degrees of freedom, that's the environment, which gives you basically the linear time-dependent derivative here, and you end up with a time-dependent Schrödinger equation for the system only. That's it. This is how time comes about from separation in space. Okay, so energy time uncertainty is now very easy. We can start with this general relation. Let's just take A as the environmental Hamiltonian, and B some coordinate of the environment. Then we have this regular uncertainty relation, which is like this. You can calculate it yourself very simply, of course. And now, of course, we know the environment is so big, we can treat it quasi-classically. This is the similar relation TUM, of course, has, but we justify it with the largeness of the environment, if you want. Delta R is velocity times delta T. So we have, in the end, this relation. And now, of course, since total energy is conserved, fluctuations of energy of environment and system are the same. And this is how we end up, basically, with the energy time uncertainty for the system, derived from a true, basically, operator-based uncertainty of the environment in the semi-classical limit. Let's see. So, now comes an example of a system without time. As I said, it's very, very difficult to observe something like that because, in the end, our apparatus is already always so big, it's classical, basically, so you have time there. And that's an interpretation, of course, for me. I think this is something we all know, where actually you could interpret this, the outcome of this experiment, that time doesn't make sense for this experiment. And that's the famous experiment by Demelt and others, the first trap experiments, a single atom in a trap. And this atom just has fluorescence, and you see this fluorescence yield here as a function of time. The atom is illuminated by a laser beam, so it makes transitions. And you see here dark intervals. And these dark intervals come from the fact that off and on the electron doesn't go down, it goes to a third state, which is metastable, weakly coupled, and this is called shelf then, and then it's out of the cycle basically, and therefore you don't see fluorescent, it's dark. Now, what I thought as a student is very, very disturbing is that basically this is a reproducible experiment in the sense you can do the same conditions and you never know what the outcome will be. So we will never be able to basically predict this time series here, because this is just stochastic, if you wish, only on average, if you basically average small intervals or some intervals of these time sequence, you will get the average length of these dark intervals as the lifetime of your metastable level. But you can't reproduce that. And now I would argue the reason is that simply this is such an intelligent setup that actually this fulfills our condition that you have two small systems you couple together, and two small systems coupled together do not make time. You need a large system. Why is that? I'll tell you in a second. So, of course, one system is the active electron, yeah, and the other system is the light field. And the light field with the number of photons has different, basically, properties here. So this is schematically, again, what I just said. You have the ground state of the atom. You drive this transition with the laser, and you observe the fluorescence here. Off and on, a weakly coupled state is basically reached by the electron, and then it decays at some later time spontaneously to the ground state again. Now, this fulfills this situation beautifully that you have basically a small system, our electronic system, just with three states, coupled to an environment where here, the system 1, 2, if you wish, it's the classical situation. Therefore, you have time and you observe the fluorescence, because in this mode, there are many, many photons. The environment is filled with a lot of photons. But here, basically, in the shelving state, here's the vacuum. So there's basically zero photons in this environment here. And therefore, basically, for the electron being here, coupled to the light field, time does not make sense. Yeah? And it's just this very clever setup that you can observe this weakly coupled system, two small systems, indirectly by the very fact that you have one electron in the system, and either it's there or it's not there. So the strong coupling here with our observation of the fluorescence, that does not influence here the small environment with zero photons present. That's a very unusual setup, and I would interpret in the light of this derivation basically the fact that you see only stochastic intervals in time as the fact that time doesn't make sense for the system. Now, of course, the question is this the only way to think about it? You can think about it, of course, in another way. You take two, let's say, equally big systems, and of course, then the asymmetry condition is violated. Now, you could think of, you take basically the following situation. You take a system which is a bit larger as an environment, but not asymptotically large, and you compare that to another situation where the environment has a different size compared to your test system. Now, in this case, you should see a back reaction of your basically environment, of your system, sorry, on the environment. This is what we know as adiabatic coupling terms in molecular physics. And the question is, and this is what I will try to think about and hopefully discuss with some of you in the next 2 weeks, can one measure the difference of the back reaction of the two different larger systems on the smaller one for these slightly asymmetric conditions? And this is, of course, very, very small time differences. So we should go to a situation where time is already defined in the sense, but time is not yet absolute because this is not big enough. So this small system cannot influence the environment. That would be the idea. All right. So much for the time derived from space. Now, the second part is, as I said, it's a bit more realistic or down to earth. It's cluster physics. That's what we've been doing for quite a while. And since I'm unfortunately the first one talking about clusters, I'll take just two slides for introduction. I'm sure there will be more from Todd or so on. So if you basically expose a cluster to a laser pulse, and that's just a typical 800 nanometer parameters here, typical strong field intensities, what happens then is that the whole cluster completely disintegrates. Let's take a rare gas cluster. You see lots of ions, many electrons, multiply charged ions. And the time scales are in the following, that the fastest time scale is, of course, that of the bound electrons to the atoms in the cluster, one atomic unit. The laser period, at least if you have 800 nanometers, is roughly a factor of 100 slower. If you take VUV, it's maybe only one order of magnitude slower, but still it's slower. Laser pulse length is again one order of magnitude longer if you take some 20 or whatever optical cycles. And ionic motion is much slower. So you might wonder, what has this to do with attosecond physics? It's nice because time scales separate. Actually doesn't help you too much. You have to more or less include them anyways in your calculation or simulation. But what does that have to do with attoseconds? One more schematic overview for you, what happens in these clusters. And this refers pretty much to many, many situations, also different wavelengths. And this is basically visualized here as a function of time with the cluster radius schematically. You see, this is your laser pulse, let's assume that. Initially, not much happens with the laser, with the cluster radius, and then the cluster starts to expand. And you have a first period of phase where you have single ionization of atoms, and basically these atoms have not realized yet that they are in a cluster environment, that there are many atoms. It's like isolated atoms, more or less only intensity dependent. Then you have a second phase, and that's the critical expansion phase where the cluster starts to expand, maybe even a bit earlier, already when barriers are down. So these atoms realize that they have neighbors, there are other ions. The cluster grows, the ion density therefore definitely decreases, and I write here the electron density changes. That's a strange term. And the reason is that I consider only electrons which are optically active, if you wish, still to the laser light which comes in. And that means these are electrons which are delivered from the ions into the cluster, but which have not left the cluster yet completely for final ionization. Yeah? And basically, you have a source and a sink term. I mean, of course, you lose electrons to total ionization, but at the same time, you deliver more and more electrons into the cluster environment from the ions, from the deeper bound ionic shells. And therefore, you can't say a priori what happens, and therefore you can only say electron density changes. And finally, you have the relaxation phase, which is important because it takes you to the experimental observables, and it's very annoying theoretically because it takes a long time to basically have all these fragments settle and recombined and so on. And now, again, this takes a long time. Yeah, it's hundreds, or this is laser pulse, maybe typically 100 femtoseconds. Now the question is, where is the attoseconds? Now you see, what is really interesting here is this phase between atomic behavior, single ionization, and the onset of basically corporate behavior, cluster behavior. And this is very fast and really critical. And I can illustrate that here with an example. I pick that because I come to that back in a second. This is energy absorption and electron production for a small argon cluster, 13 argon atoms, with a pulse length of 120 femtoseconds. It's actually a VUV pulse, the reason I come to in a second, at 7 times 10 to the 13 watts per square centimeter. And you see here, these are the inionized electrons, and this is the absorbed energy, basically. So this is pure photoionization, sorry, yeah, by this VUV pulse. And this is the energy absorbed by each atom, basically as a function of time, also through inverse Bremsstrahlung. And you see initially what happens here is really very fast, and that's what we're interested in. This is also what we don't understand very well. If one is honest, one, you know, we are just guessing more or less here, because there's no observation so far about this process. What has been measured, of course, is the production of ions in the very end. Energy resolved, not time resolved. I'll finish even faster. I'll get two G's, I think. So, now, you see, again, the laser pulse here, of course, that was this 120 femtoseconds. And the question is, why am I interested in the VUV pulse? And, of course, the experts among you know that there was this beautiful experiment a couple of years ago in the first phase of the basically free electron laser in Hamburg when they had some 13 eV radiation at exactly this intensity. And this is the experimental result from Thomas Möller's group, published in Nature in 2002. And you see here the atom, its time of flight measurements, more or less raw data if you wish, the atom basically, and then you see a small cluster that produces xenon. Doubly charged ions, and as bigger as the cluster gets, as more highly charged ions you get out. You don't find any basically xenon 2 or something, it's all ions, but they get more and more highly charged. And we could also model that, and this is what I will tell you about in a second, of course. And so LEDs qualitatively, it's in relatively good agreement. One has to be cautious because like laser focus and efficiency, I mean laser focus is in here, but efficiency of the detector has not been included. They actually didn't report that. So it's not totally clear if the agreement is really as good. I should also mention that there are like three theories right now on the market, if you wish. The first one comes from Chris Green's group with Robin Santra, and Thomas Brabets also had an idea how this works, published here in 2005. And now an attosecond time resolved measurement could probably distinguish between these three theories and might actually prove all of them wrong. Who knows? And this is how it could come about. I will tell you in two slides. But I would like to make a more general point before, because I think this comes back to this importance of basically incoherent processes and also the fastness of certain processes here to be probed. So that's just an overview of what happens in a nutshell in our theory, of course. I don't have time to go into detail with the others. You see here basically the inner ionized electrons as a function of time. This is how long the laser pulse lasts. This is 100 femtoseconds here. And you see there was xenon 80, so that's quite a few electrons per atom are inner ionized, something like sixfold. And this is what should be measured in the end. These are the outer ionized electrons. So this is really what you can see at your detector. And you see even long after the laser pulse is over, electrons are boiled off. But you see much fewer electrons only coming out than they are inner ionized. And the reason is, what we think is that you really have inverse Bremsstrahlung as the main mechanism. I think we all agree on that, actually, in theory, which gives you this boiling off. You have a Boltzmann distribution. You create a micro or nano plasma. And also you have charge imbalances, very small quiver motion. This is not homogeneous field anymore, driving the electrons back and forth compared to 800 nanometers. And, of course, the question is, why can we, in our basically model or picture, why can we ionize so many electrons internally? Of course, they can't escape. They don't have enough energy. But this is very important because this makes the inverse Bremsstrahlung very effective, right? If you have highly charged ions intermediately, then you have very effective inverse Bremsstrahlung. And we think the reason is the following. If you have basically an isolated xenon ion, then you need two photons to ionize it further to double plus. But if you have cluster ions in the neighborhood of other ions, the barriers come down, and you see it's always sufficient, even up to six-fold ionization, to have one photon deliver another electron into the cluster environment. So that's the idea. You kind of climb the ladder, and you have very effective inner ionization. Of course, this doesn't let you get out from the cluster as a whole, right? Because here it's very high to escape for outer ionization. Now, this also tells you, and that's very important, that basically the charging dynamics here is relatively fast, while the relaxation dynamics, of course, is very slow. Oh, you kind of knew that before. And we are interested to learn about the charging dynamics. The relaxation dynamics, in a way, you can also measure in other ways, but the charging dynamics, it's over anyways later on, and it's fast. So we would be very keen and interested to see how this works. And that's just kind of a very short little attempt to see that, what would happen in our theory. So this is basically now the VUV probe pulse and a time-delayed attosecond, no, a VUV pump pulse, sorry, and time-delayed attosecond probe pulse. And we can take this argon, now it's 13, again, with the parameters I had already. And basically, we are now looking at these early times here where the charging takes place. And what I do now, I will show you results where we have basically superimposed our probe pulse of attosecond duration with a certain well-defined time delay here, up to, I think, 40 femtoseconds. But always an attosecond pulse. That is, we basically kick out electrons from the bound ions here, 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 and here. Yeah, and that basically probes the charge state of the ions at that time, early on in the pulse. Now let's see how this works. The question is, do we see them at all? So what you see here is basically the kinetic energy of the electrons coming out. And you see here, this is simply the Boltzmann distribution of our plasma electrons. And so here we have 2.5 femtosecond time delay for the attopulse. And this is where we would expect basically the single ionized, double ionized, and so on peak of the electrons coming out from the attopulse if they would not be surrounded by space charge, an isolated basically atom. Of course, this is shifted to the left because they have to run against other charges. Yeah, and you see here very nicely that the peak evolves, and this is also what you expect. It evolves more and more to the left because, I mean, the cluster is more and more ionized. But we believe that you could actually see these atto-ejected electrons and can distinguish them from the normal plasma cluster electrons. And this would give you a time-resolved charging picture. Of course, this hinges upon our model, yeah, that charging really takes place like that and that we have highly charged ions. In reality, it might look very different if the model doesn't apply. But this would be, I think, very interesting to see, and we hope that this can be measured in the future. This is just subtracted the basically Boltzmann distributed plasma electrons, so you see again here how this looks like. And with that, I think I'm at the end. And I don't have an outlook or summary yet, hopefully after the next few weeks. But I would like to thank, of course, my collaborators in the cluster part. It's Ulf Salman, the PhD students. And on time, it's my advisor from times ago and still collaborator, John Briggs in Freiburg. Thanks for your attention.
When you create attoseconds from atoms and molecules, so they are identical. If you work with clusters, clusters are different in form and number of particles and so on. Does it produce, the dispersion produce some difficulty?
It's absolutely true. I mean, what the worst part is, you have a size distribution normally as clusters are produced right now. Yeah, I think what we work with here is basically closed shell clusters, therefore these strange numbers, 13 and so on. So they have a relatively well-defined shape. Yeah, they're kind of identical, if you wish, if you would be able to produce them in single size. Unfortunately, you are not so far. So you have a cluster size distribution like 13, 14, 15, then they are not identical in shape and not in number, and this will have an influence. That's certainly true. On the other hand, this charging dynamics, it should be relatively robust. So at least the main trend and basically the ability to distinguish between several theoretical models should be given.
What is your estimate? So how big dispersion will kill attosecond?
Will kill it?
Yeah.
I don't know. We haven't done that. I mean, if you go to larger clusters, this will be better, of course. But in larger clusters, other things will kill you because then your mean free path is too short and actually your attosecond electrons will not have this signature, right? Because they collide more. So I would expect that actually it will be okay. Because you might lose these single peaks of single, double, triple ionization. They will be at different positions, but you will see this blob basically of attosecond generated electrons, and you will see the main, or let's say the average charge of your ions in the cluster. And that's already a matter of dispute. Is it very low, like what is measured in the end, or is it intermediately very high, as we claim, sixfold versus twofold? And I'm sure you can distinguish that.
You showed here how you can use the attosecond pulses to observe the charging dynamics in the XUV. Have you also thought about to what extent you might be able to use attosecond pulses to observe collective electron dynamics as it plays a role in the IR?
Yeah, we have.
And?
All right. The problem is that the collective electrons don't couple so well to the attoseconds. So with this scheme, we don't think it will be in a just analogous way possible to do that. There might be a way that if they're really reflected very well from edges of the, you know, of the common cluster potential, like which goes up, that this you could see then with the attoseconds. But this depends again quite a bit on the model or the way you're modeling.
Just a time question here. I mean, time is closely connected to entropy. I'm surprised that you have not mentioned anything about entropy.
Yeah, that is true. Okay, I have a very cheap and dirty way out in saying basically that we're not sure that everything is not basically reversible, but in a way that it never comes back, like revival, you know, with a very high, basically, irrational fraction, yeah? That basically, if you diverse many more objects, again and again, further and further, then your wave packet or whatever it will be, it will never come back in our lifetime. So this would be my explanation.
Okay, I don't see any more questions, and there, I believe, is wine and cheese waiting for us out here. So let's thank all our speakers for the session.